Good morning, everybody. How is everyone this morning? Very good. My welcome, I guess, to Tech Ed 2013 here in New Zealand. My name is Steve Hopkins. I'm a member of the Yammer crew from Australia and New Zealand. I'm very, very, very proud to sort of be here today to introduce Adam Pisoni, who's the CTO and co-founder of Yammer, to you. When we sort of started organising this trip maybe about 4 months ago, and we were really excited to be able to come out here and for Adam to come out here and to sort of discuss some of the things that we're beginning to see with our customers and also just beginning to see in society in general. But more generally, today as part of the SharePoint track, you're going to get a lot of different information and a lot of really good information about everything from just managing SharePoint through complex environments, more stuff on search, as well as sort of some of the, as well as the importance of social enterprise and how that's really impacting all of our customers, but why it's also the sort of thing that seems to be driving just the way customers are beginning to think about the way they run their businesses. And to sort of give you a little bit of an example about just how that's different. When I started at Yammer about 2 years ago, I remember sort of on my first or second day, there's lunch and everybody's kind of gathering around at lunch and we all sort of, you know what it's like on your first day, you're kind of a little bit shy, you're trying to get to know people, everything else. Sort of went and sat down as I started eating lunch with some of the other people that were in my team. And Adam comes down and sits down next to us. And I think, from there on, he proceeded to sort of ask me questions and say, oh, hey, you're new. Oh, you're from Australia. Oh, wow, tell me about that. What are the clients like there? How do you know that? And, he was just a normal guy, really. And then he left and the guys were like, oh, that was Adam, that was the CTO. And, being new, I was blown away. But I think that's, for me at the time, that was a really great example about how Yammer itself was really changing what it meant to be an organization and a company where there's no hierarchy and everybody's just getting on with doing the job. And we've now really taken that approach to the product itself and are really helping our clients, who are, many companies that are some of the biggest in the world, understand how to do that and create that sort of culture in their own environments. So Adam's going to talk to you a little bit about that today, and then we'll kick on with the rest of the track. So thank you very much. If you'd like to give a warm welcome to Adam Pisoni, CTO and co-founder of Yammer.
Sweet. All right. This is going to be a little bit weird, I think, in that we're part of the SharePoint track, but we're not going to be talking about technology too specifically. But I'll give you a little background about why you should care about what I'm going to talk about. First of all, I'm sure at the keynote yesterday, you heard a lot about all the pace of change, technology, and how much is coming and all this change. And obviously, our customers, your customers, the people that you may work at a company, you may be at a consultancy which helps companies, are dealing with this pace of this onslaught of change and technology. And I remember I was at TechEd in Australia last week. And during the keynote, that was the theme was like, there's more is going to come, more faster, more. And I remember thinking that as a person that manages companies or a person that works within a company, that's awesome because we love more technology. It helps us. But it's also a bit terrifying because, how are you supposed to deal with all this? How are you supposed to keep up and be competitive when there's just so much new stuff to take advantage of, especially in light of sort of how we thought about technology historically, where there's like a new technology trend, you get to know it, you've got a good 5-10 years to figure it out. Once you figure it out, maybe there's a next trend, and now the next trend is tomorrow, is the next day, it keeps going. And in fact, a lot of the software that we built in the past couple decades to help us make companies better companies seem to not be working as well as they used to. Companies are churning through them faster. They're in constant upgrade cycles of trying to get the software that they invested in to handle the problems of today. And all of that is because there's some pretty fundamental changes happening within companies today as they're trying to respond to the new business environment they're in. And that impacts all of us because we help build software, we help implement software, we help give people, companies technology that helps them make them better companies. And so it is imperative for us to understand where companies are going because it helps inform the solutions they'll need and the challenges that they'll face. So this is going to be a little strange compared to perhaps some of the other presentations, but this is why you'll want to know. First of all, how many people here remember Tower Records? Was that something in New Zealand at all? I see a couple hands. All right. I wasn't sure if it made it here. That was funny. When I landed in Australia, the first thing I saw was a Blockbuster store that was closing. And that was the other example that I constantly use. So Tower Records obviously was a retail chain that sold music, records at first, and then tapes and CDs, because they were innovating and trying to keep along with changes in their customer demand. They actually launched in 1960 and were very successful. For 40 years, they grew nationally across the US, eventually expanded internationally. I guess they made it here. In 1999, they peaked with sales of over $1 billion, which is pretty good for music retail. At that same year, if you remember, there were some other services like Napster that peaked their ugly head. And then a couple years later, we saw the rise of the iTunes Music Store, which sort of like was a legitimized online music. In 2004, less than 5 years after Tower Records peaked, they filed for bankruptcy. And that's incredible, to go for 40 years of rise and then go out of business in less than 5 years. Ironically, the thing that most disrupted them, the iTunes Music Store, itself began to get disrupted a few years later with the launch of Ardio and Spotify. Spotify doubled its market share in 2011. There are countless examples of disruption that we see, of old models that very rapidly get disrupted. In fact, the Fortune 500 churns at a rate of 8% a year. Less than half the companies that were in the Fortune 500 in 1995 are still there today. This idea that we have these stable companies and these stable technologies that can propel us forward forever is simply a farce. And so we all feel this increasing pace of change, but let me just answer this question. Why is the pace of change increasing? In fact, is the pace of change increasing? What's the cause of it? Because I bet if you went back to business books from the 80s, they'd be talking all about having to keep up with the increasing pace of change. It's 2013, we're still talking about it. Is it really changing faster? I believe that fundamentally, the thing that drives the pace of change is the open flow of communication. Is that the more people can quickly connect, the more people can learn new information, the faster information travels between people, the more things change. And that's because as you learn new information, you change your behavior. You change your expectations. Just as an example, I was thinking the other day about, I grew up, I was a child in the 80s, which seems like a long time ago now. And I've so rarely encountered new information. I actually was into computers back then, but I had a BBS that people would dial into. There's not a lot of new information there. It was one person at a time. And then, I would watch the news maybe, but I was young. All of that was filtered very narrowly. There were only a couple news stations. Maybe I read the paper again. That was very narrow. I'd go to school. Most of that is history. It's not a lot of current events there. And then when I was in third grade, we were watching live as the Challenger spacecraft took off and blew up. And it was teachers on board, and that's it. And I remember being really impactful, thinking, man, I just saw, I saw something that sort of impacted my view of the world. It was the first time I had thought of things like mortality, Every day now, we encounter new information. Every day, we hear about world events that change our opinion of the world. Every day, we see someone with a new technology in their pocket or hand that we get jealous of and want. Every day, we see a new innovation or a new disruption. And all of this, and then we get to communicate back. We get to hear something new, communicate it back through all the channels that we have. So fundamentally, the pace of change is increasing because the pace of information is increasing, because it is easier to connect, because people have figured out more effective ways of talking. Okay, so that explains why the pace of change is increasing, but it doesn't explain why companies get disrupted just because that pace of change increases. To understand this, and this is something that is maybe the most abstract, but maybe the most important, you have to understand that when we think about the companies that we all work at today, and the way that they work, the way they operate, the way they organize, their org charts, and the way they break things up functionally, and the way they do rewards, and the way they pay people, and all of those things, that was not discovered. People kind of think that the modern company was sort of discovered like gravity. But it was invented. It was invented at a particular time to solve a particular set of challenges. And you can go back and read the early works of Frederick Taylor, and in fact, the East Indian Trading Company, and when they came up with the ideas of company and why they created these structures. And fascinatingly, a lot of the beliefs that they were basing their designs off of, we don't believe in anymore today. For example, if you read those sort of early Frederick Taylor works, one of the core beliefs was that there was one right way to do anything, and employees were too dim to figure it out for themselves. And so it was up to the sort of management class to figure out the one best way and enforce it on their employees, but never let them change it, because it would never need to change once you found the perfect way. Well, obviously, that's ridiculous. There's no company today that thinks they're never going to need to change, or that every process they have is perfect, or even that their employees are dim and can't be trusted with anything. Even if we go back maybe 10 or 20 years, there were probably classes of employees that we thought, well, we don't want them to really have opinions at all. But nowadays, even what we're seeing in retail, we want our employees to provide feedback. We need that feedback. And so these mechanisms, we created these mechanisms to make companies rigid. We added process and structure and bureaucracy. We added these things to make them immovable, because that's what we wanted from companies. And so it's no wonder that we're having this problem with companies unable to keep up with the pace of change. Now, all of that is sort of hearsay. So I'm going to talk about some specific studies which are showing these trends. When company was invented, the majority of work was routine. You were building cars, or you were making farm equipment, and every person had a specific job in the pipeline, and you didn't want them to change what they did. You wanted very little variance in their work. And so that work was routine. It was routine because you could tell them exactly what to do, and if they did exactly what you told them, then everything was okay. Increasingly, the work that we do within companies is non-routine. Everybody's work here is non-routine. If we're implementing software, if we're writing software, it involves creativity and self-direction. Nobody can tell us exactly what keys to press every day, so we understand this. But you have to understand that for most people in enterprises, they're in this confused state where their work is becoming non-routine, but their companies treat them like it is routine. Their call center employees, they're lots of classes of stuff. And what we're seeing is that this is increasing dramatically, even just up from 2010, when the amount of non-routine work in enterprises was 25%. It's going to be at 40% in just a couple of years. We built companies for a world where 95% of the work was routine. And now we're getting to a point where half the work is non-routine. And what I said before about these employees who are stuck in this weird situation where they're in an environment built for routine work, but they're increasingly find themselves in non-routine times, if you will, is what I think is causing this epidemic we have of increasing employee disengagement. A lot of, when Yammer started taking off, a lot of our customers came to us because this was their problem. They said, we need to fix our employee engagement problem. There are these studies that show that companies that have highly engaged employees outperform their peers by 167%, by massive quantities. And so companies are like, how do I fix my employee engagement problem? That employee engagement problem, which is increasing, is directly related to that rise in non-routine work. Because you imagine that you're this employee who's been told, do exactly this, here's your rules, here's your incentives, here's your structures, and then every day they come to work and they encounter new information that they're unequipped or unempowered to handle. And all of this leaves them disillusioned and disengaged, because if the company won't let them do the obvious right thing, why should they care? Why, if the company doesn't care about the company, why should I care about the company? And in fact, one of my sort of favorite studies is called the Shift Index, which I think perfectly illustrates the convergence of these trends. The Shift Index shows that even though productivity has been increasing for the past 40 years, meaning we're getting better at making our companies more efficient, return on assets, which is a key measure of performance, has been declining the entire time. Companies are literally getting worse and worse as they try to get better and better. Because as they try to double down on the old ways, on focusing on efficiency, they get worse as the pace of change increases. Okay, so all of this has been a bunch of bad news. And I'll make one other point about this, which is, you imagine the way companies worked in the past. You had an idea for a product. You were going to build it for a long time. Wasn't a lot of need to change or to iterate. I'm sure you saw in the keynote discussions about how For example, Microsoft Office is moving from three-year cycles down to quarterly, and then maybe weekly, and then maybe even faster than that. You know, why would this be? So at the core of the problem with companies, the very, very core of why we're going to see companies dramatically change their technology, the way they organize, the way they communicate, is because a massive divergence has happened between the way people can communicate in their personal lives and the way companies deal with information. You see, companies get disrupted when their customers begin to move faster than they do. That seems obvious, right? But how does that happen? Well, essentially, people, us humans, have figured out really effective ways of communicating. We network. We immediately connect and share information in super fluid ways. Companies are on this old model where every once in a while they pop up their head and say, okay, give me some new information. I'll go back and process it, and a couple years later, or a decade later even, I'm going to come back with a new rev of something. And so all these companies are struggling with how do they have as fast a feedback loop as their customers themselves have. And so, in fact, you look at the example of Tower Records. In hindsight, when we look at it, it's easy to say, wow, and that disruption happened so fast. There was no way they could have seen it coming. That's not true at all. They did see it coming. They were getting signals in 1996 and 7 that something was changing. But their company wasn't ready to take in new information. They didn't build their company to take in new information. They built it to just do what they were doing as efficiently as possible. A proof point of this, actually, is in the 2000-2001 timeframe, Tower Records noticed an increase in returns. And what they found was that people were buying CDs from their stores, going home, ripping them to MP3, and then returning the CDs. What a strong signal. Something in your customer is changing. What do they do to react? They changed the return policy so that if you open the CD case, you couldn't return it. As if they could like stop the future from happening, as opposed to trying to get in front of their customer and learn more quickly about what was changing. So this is the core of our problem, is changing the way companies work so that they don't focus purely on efficiency, but instead focus on how do they learn and respond faster. And that is the good news. The good news is that even though we're talking about the increased pace of change, which not only affects companies, but all the individuals in this room, as you're dealing with this onslaught of technology, that increased pace of change, which may freak you and the companies you work for out, is the same for everybody. It is not different for you than anybody else. It's not different for your company than anybody else, which means this is a level playing field, which means there are people, the people in this room even, who can take this pace of change and turn it into a competitive advantage for you or your company. But it does require a fundamental mindset shift in how you think about what your job is and what the job of your company is. It is no longer the job of a company to do whatever they're doing as efficiently as possible. It is now the job to compete on how quickly you learn and respond to information. That is the new orientation of companies. And let me just give you an example of what this means at sort of fundamental levels. This has all been really abstract. Zara is a fashion company in Spain. Zara is one of my perfect examples of what we call responsive organizations, which are these companies which in every way optimize for the open flow of information, for how to work together as a network, for how to get closer to their customers, to get faster feedback, to learn and respond more rapidly. Zara is not even a customer of ours. I'm just using them because they're a great example. Fashion is intuitively something that has a temporal nature. Fashion goes out of fashion quickly, so you have to get the right things on the shelf as quick as possible. Now imagine you wanted to start a fashion company. You would probably, because we create all companies almost the same way, you would create a company that has divisions, a manufacturing division, a retail division, a design division, a distribution division. And in order to create a new garment, it would sort of walk through those chains. It would start in design, and they'd work on stuff. And when it was perfect, they'd hand it off to manufacturing. And when it was perfect, they'd hand it off to distribution. It would take a long time to get a new garment from design to the store shelf. Zara realized that even though they have an org chart that looks like a normal company, that didn't mean they had to work that way. So what Zara does is they take people from across their org chart, and they pull them out, and they organize them around garment. They say, you, whatever, 10 people, however big that group is, your job is this one garment from the beginning to the end. And they are not constrained by divisional budgets, by divisional politics. They're not constrained by making sure everything is perfect before they hand it off. They can innovate across those boundaries, if you will. And in this way, Zara can get a garment from the design phase to the store shelf in 15 days, which is miraculous for any company to be able to do anything in 15 days, to innovate in 15 days. Now, when a lot of people hear this story, they think, wow, that's really interesting. They can get more products out to their customers. They can release faster. But that's not the interesting part. What's interesting is that by organizing in a way that allows them to move that quickly, they have fundamentally changed the whole game for their industry. Because what they've done is they've decreased the cost of failure so that they can increase their rate of experimentation. And because of that, they've instituted new things where from the stores, they get really fast feedback from their frontline employees about people asking for clothes they don't have. So someone comes in and wants a red jacket. Next day, somebody wants a red jacket. They can so quickly respond. Now, they don't know whether red jackets are really going to sell well, but they can so quickly do a small batch, test it, and see if it does well that they can move their resources around almost overnight. They can double down on what's working. They can move resources away from what's not. All because they've organized in a way, they've oriented in a way where they're literally trying to increase, if you think about it, the rate of failure. By decreasing the cost of failure, they increase their rate of experimentation, which means they're failing more, but they're also more effective as a company. So let me ask real quickly, because I've been up here rambling about this stuff, how did sort of Yammer get involved in all this, and what does this have to do with Yammer? We're going to talk about some of these changes that companies are making, some of the shifts that are making them more responsive organizations. But at a really core level, how they communicate is a big piece of it. And in fact, the reason why their customers, companies' customers, are themselves moving so much faster, learning, sharing so much faster, is because they communicate differently. Because the world at large has figured out how to communicate as networks, has figured out how to instantly find the people that have things that are interesting. And the reason why companies are unable to themselves learn and share as fast is because they tend to organize and communicate as hierarchies, which were not built to share or change. And so at its core, Yammer is an internal social network. It's a new communication system that helps companies become responsive companies by letting them communicate as networks, by letting them communicate in more fluid ways, by encouraging more open communication so that information can flow more fluidly to the people, to that non-routine worker on the front line who needs to make a decision. And we want to empower to make that decision, but they need the right information at that moment. Where does that information come from? As people work more openly, that information becomes available to more people. So that's essentially how we got caught up in this. And in fact, sort of ironically, myself and another guy, David Sachs, started Yammer in 2008. The idea was there was this thing in the consumer space called Facebook. We think it's going to go into the enterprise. We honestly had no idea what was going to happen. We just kind of put it there. And he and I had not been worked at big enterprises before. And it took off so fast within companies and began to change their culture. It began to have such a radical impact that we struggled for years to figure out what the heck is going on. We didn't know this was going to happen. And it was through talking to our customers that we began to see all these shifts. We began to see companies at the vanguard who were trying to evolve to be able to handle this pace of change. And how they communicate and how they broke down organizational barriers and silos was a huge piece of that. So, what I want to do now is go through these shifts that companies are making internally. I've talked about this to CEOs, to CIOs, all the way down to people from across the org. What I want to do for you guys is try to contextualize this a little bit in terms of how this impacts the technology that they use, because that's an important part. Because if you think about it, the people in this room help purchase, buy, install, customize, roll out technology for companies. But companies buy technology because it helps them solve problems. Companies are facing a new set of problems because they're having to change what it means to be a company. And those are the sets of problems that people here have an opportunity to help them solve, if that makes any sense. So we sort of talked about this first shift briefly. Our big problem is that customers have figured out how to network. Companies have not. companies still operate as hierarchies, where we sort of predefine everything everyone's going to do, lay them out, and it'll never need to change, right? And yet we see the churn that happens within companies as nothing gets done. I was talking to a CIO just 2 days last week from a large Australian company, and they said, you know, nothing gets done, nothing can get done, we're in meetings all the time. And I asked him, what's wrong? What do you think is the problem? And he said, the org chart is the problem. We can't get anything done in the org chart. We're in meetings all day because we're handing things between groups and negotiating when another group's going to do the work. Fundamentally, the problem is companies are still working in hierarchies, but the world has moved to networks. Let me give you an example. There was a guy on vacation in Florida with his family in an RV. RV broke down, called his local insurance broker. Local insurance broker said, you're not covered. The guy was stuck. So instead, the guy called Nationwide, which is a large insurance company in the US. I think they're just in the US, one of our customers. And one of these frontline, non-information worker, non-routine worker help desk people answered the phone. Also didn't know the information, didn't know if they were covered. But instead of giving up, instead of escalating, they posted a question, a message to their internal Yammer network saying, I have this customer, here's the problem, I don't know what to do. People from across the org in different parts of the company, from the claims division, from the product division, came together to answer that person's question to say, I'm not sure either, let me help. And they worked together cross-functionally to solve that customer's problem. It turned out there was a way in which he was covered. But not only that, they were able to get emergency funds to get the customer back on the road. I mean, if you think about it, that's almost the opposite experience we've all had with customer service, where usually it seems more often than not we call and they can't help us, that their playbooks, their instructions, their rules, their knowledge and empowerment makes them unable to help us. It's the most frustrating thing. Why have a call center if they can't help us? Well, fundamentally, what Nationwide did here is they started to work as a network. They realized that it is impossible to predetermine all the questions a call center person, as an example, are going to get. The only way to get the most up-to-date information is to connect the organization as a network. And it works both ways, right? That customer service person is feeding information back. One of our other customers, NAB, you know, NAB, big bank, they are using they're connecting their frontline call center people to people back further in the company to close that feedback loop between those frontline customers and the rest of the company so they can much more quickly respond to problems. They're working together as a network. And again, it makes sense. The information in the world has become a network. It is no longer rigid taxonomies. So as an example, how does this impact the products that companies buy and build and use? It used to be that we created these knowledge management systems. We had these complex curated taxonomies. Information is exploding. Companies are no longer going to work purely within the org chart. The products that they buy and use, the solutions, have to scale with the network of information that are going to be required to service their customers. So this changes, again, everything from the roles within companies that used to be curating all that content and creating those taxonomies are going away on a lot of fronts because they just can't keep up with the amount of technology. It can't keep up with what the network is. It means companies are having to relinquish a lot of control over the information that they have because they can't keep up with it. They need people to have the most up-to-date information. But again, it makes sense when we think about how customers have become a network themselves, and it takes a network to serve a network. The next big shift we're going to talk about is this shift of companies going from trying to control everything about their employees to empowering their employees. And again, when we think about this rise of non-routine work, that it was the case before that companies thought we just tell everybody exactly what to do, and if they do exactly what they're told, everyone's going to be fine. And that's just a falsehood now, if you will. Let me give you a good example, actually. One of our customers is Red Robin, which is a hamburger chain. And hamburger chains, you'd think, don't have to think much about disruption, but I was talking to their CIO, and they actually have a lot of problems with new classes of food, of changing customer bases that change their revenue, that in some cases can create existential crises for them. They're a hamburger chain, and they think about disruption just as much as anybody else. One of the problems in food is that changing your menu is dangerous and expensive. You do it infrequently because if you make a mistake, it takes a long time to realize you've made a mistake and to correct it. Now, it was funny because when I was talking to their CIO, Chris Slaping, I was thinking about software development because I'm part of Microsoft Office, and this is a conversation that comes up all the time. When you used to change Office every 3 years, that's a dangerous change. What if you're wrong? What if you started down the wrong path? What if you have an IT project that's a year, 2 years long, and you're drifting down the wrong path? How long does it take to even find out? So what companies have historically done, and what Red Robin was faced with, was do we try to make it safer to release burgers? Do we try to reduce the rate of failure by changing the menu less frequently so that we can do more research ahead of time? Or do we try to change the menu more frequently? Do we try to increase the rate of change so that we can decrease the cost of failure? This is almost exactly the conversations that I remember having with the people literally who run Microsoft Office and engineering, that there's this fear of changing too quickly because mistakes are expensive. But of course, if you can change quickly, mistakes are cheaper, and that changes everything. Well, so what Robin, again, realized, man, if we could collect feedback faster, then we can respond faster, we can have better changes to our menu and do them more frequently, and it'll just better overall. The problem was they couldn't figure out how to get faster feedback. Their customers didn't want to go to Twitter and Facebook to talk about burgers, and then an epiphany happened. They realized that all the feedback they needed was coming into the company, but it was coming into their frontline servers. These people who don't have emails, they're non-knowledge workers, they're sort of supposed to be those routine workers. But what they realized is that all employees are knowledge workers. All employees are doing things where they're collecting feedback that can help the company. So they took all their servers, they literally put them on a Yammer network, they let them use their mobile phones while they were working, and they said, look, we're going to try to release this burger in a way where you, the frontline servers, can quickly provide feedback and respond to customers. And because we can do that, we can release to fewer stores at first, we can let the stores iterate independently, we can just really quickly collect feedback. They had this new burger called the Tavern Burger. They thought it was going to take them 18 months to release, because that's what it took before. They were able to release this burger in 4 weeks, and they believe that their return on that burger, beyond just being able to do it quicker, was higher because they were able to tailor that burger more towards their customers' needs because they could collect faster feedback. But it required them realizing that we have to empower those frontline employees, we have to empower all employees to have a voice, to provide feedback, and to be able to respond more quickly to changing customer needs. If the name of the game is how quickly you can learn and respond to information, then there's no faster response than when an employee learns something new and can respond to it immediately. So it makes sense that companies are trying to push down decision-making as low as possible. How does this affect the software that they buy? In the old days, we had such a Byzantine controls over what people could do, especially lower down the org chart. And what we're seeing with, obviously, the rise of consumerization is that there is actually now an attempt to empower those employees, to let them do more, to have fewer controls. The companies are still scared of information leakage and all that, but they're more terrified of not knowing what they know. They're more terrified of not being able to collect fast enough feedback to change. And so we're seeing a dramatic increase in bringing technology to, for example, frontline employees. Increase in mobility, increase in empowerment, increase in giving communication to all employees, not just a select few. This next one may be a little abstract, but it's funny because when I talk to business leaders, it is always the first question they ask. When they realize that they have to work more as a network than a hierarchy, they always sort of tilt their head and say, well, how does this impact how we reward our employees? When you go back to when most companies were manufacturing, and most of the work was routine, we had a very simple reward mechanism. We had carrots and sticks. You do the right thing, you get a reward. You excel, you get a bigger reward. You do the wrong thing, you get punished. And it worked. It actually works. If you want someone to do something very specific, you know ahead of time exactly what you need them to do, that mechanism works. But what the research tells us is that if, as the work becomes more non-routine, as the work requires creativity and self-direction, that those mechanisms actually backfire. They're actually counterproductive. They actually prevent people, in many cases, from working together. So I'm going to give you two quick examples. One is one of our customers is Jamba Juice. They're a national, U.S. national juice chain. They're partially franchise-owned. They're partially company-owned. And because they're so diffuse, they have a difficult time keeping a consistent customer experience. They want their core values, have fun, and you know they want people to come in and have a good time. And but how do you get employees motivated to have that kind of behavior? That's not something that's really easy to measure the funness of an employee. And so historically, what did they do? They would take posters and put them up in the break room that says, be fun, you know, and as if that was going to be the thing, oh, I'm supposed to be fun, now I understand what I'm supposed to do. It didn't work, obviously. It had no impact whatsoever. So instead, they ran a contest. They just literally ran a contest where they essentially said anyone in the company could nominate another person who exhibited the core values, who they saw do something. And people could submit videos and stories. And they ran the contest in a public group within Yammer, so the whole company could see what was happening. And that was the key. First of all, the contest went viral. They had hundreds of submissions because those employees started to get such fast feedback on their actions. As they did things which exhibited their core values, other people chimed in and said, wow, that was amazing. The leadership chimed in and said, that's, you know, that's awesome. That was exactly what we're looking for. And it reinforced this is how you get ahead. These are the things that what it means to be a good employee here. There's this a book called Drive by Daniel Pink where he researched how do you motivate non-directed work. And what he found was that it requires three things: autonomy, mastery, and purpose. It means that an individual feels like they can make their own decisions. Well, we need more of that anyway. It means that feels like in making these decisions, they can learn and get better at their job. They feel like they're getting better. And most importantly, they can directly connect their decisions and their work to the purpose of the company. Well, this is, again, a pretty dramatic change in how companies work. I'll give you one other story, which, because we've been talking a lot of the sort of retail non-information worker space. I was talking to a law firm, and this, I think, is going to speak to some of the technology challenges company face as well. I was speaking to a law firm, and he said to me, the way law firms made money was labor arbitrage. Was that we had, the lawyer knew about law, and the customer didn't, and we would charge more money for that information. It's information asymmetry. The problem is, information is widely available now. You don't know. That lawyer may not actually have more information than the customer. Furthermore, customer could just hire a lawyer for themselves. Why do they need a law firm? And so what they realized was that the value of the law firm was no longer the individual lawyers. It was actually their network. It was the network of lawyers inside the law firm that was quickly learning and changing and understanding current events and could work in many different fields at the same time. And so that law firm began to attempt to organize lawyers around customers in a cross-functional way, cross-disciplinary, cross-practice. But then they realized they had a fundamental problem. Lawyers are rewarded by the hour. You bill these hours. And the more hours you bill, the better you are as a lawyer. And your manager does well if you do well. And that individual competition for hours was preventing that law firm from acting as a network. It was sort of forcing the hierarchy by the way that they were incentivized. And so this law firm was literally thinking about doing away with billable hours. Not because they thought they could make more money doing away with billable hours, because they didn't know if they could survive if they couldn't work together as a network. And they saw that having these sort of individual hierarchical incentive structures was preventing them from working together as a network. I know that was kind of an abstract one. The last one I'm going to talk about in the beginning we talked about how companies have to figure out how to work like a network, just like their customers. The last thing companies are realizing is that network is more than just their employees. That the only way to get fast enough information and feedback is for that network to include their partners, their suppliers, distributors, and all that, as well as their customers. There's all these examples of companies that are beginning to work with their partners and customers as if they were part of the same company almost. I'm going to give one or two examples. One, Westfield, you know, Westfield, big shopping mall center. Westfield has all these big shopping centers. And there's all these retailers in their shopping centers. And even though those retailers literally are physically in the same space, they have no way of communicating. They're just physically there. They were telling me that two stores could be next to each other, and those owners may never speak to each other, not know each other's names, they can't help each other out. So what Westfield did is they literally created this external network, a social network, a Yammer social network for every shopping center so that the stores could communicate. But strangely enough, when they first did it, their idea was we need a way to broadcast information to our retailers. It didn't even occur to them that the retailers might want to talk to each other. So we'll just put them here and we could just yell at them this way. And what they found was that very quickly these retailers started to talk together. They started to share notes and ideas. And in one case, a pipe burst in a mall during business hours. And because these retailers could communicate with each other, they were able to respond so much more rapidly and get back to business much faster. Now, one of the funny parts is they were telling me that now that their retailers can communicate more effectively, in some ways it's pushing Westfield to have to communicate more effectively internally, because sometimes these customers have better information by talking to each other than they have talking to their coworkers, that they are able to talk more effectively than they are. And so that's pushing them to work more as a network internally as well. This is, you know, one of the biggest changes we see here, for example, in the technology space is why suddenly was there this push to be able to share files outside your company? That was sacrosanct. It's not just because people want to share files outside their company. It's because the boundary of the company is changing. The company is no longer just the employees. The organization includes customers and partners now. Those people are going to become increasingly part of projects and the work that they do. That systems which draw these very hard boundaries are going to have a very difficult time evolving into this new world. In an extreme example, NAB, again the bank, in their new building, built a large open working space, which is for customers, where they're inviting customers to come work at their offices. Because they thought, well, man, if we could just get them to come here, we can talk so much faster with them, we'll give them free internet. I'm not even exactly sure what they think they're going to use with it, but they intuitively understand the closer we get with our customers, the faster those feedback loops with our customers and partners, the faster we can learn to respond. This is going to have a dramatic impact on the technology we use. Another example, it was the case before that because your company could dictate the technology and platforms that every employee used, that you could sort of mandate, well, it's okay that it only works in these ways. But suddenly, when you have to interact with customers and partners, you can't dictate what they use. And so having that information, communication, collaboration be something that works with other people is just as important as how well it works inside your company. All of these shifts that we're seeing are shifts that companies are making to become what we call responsive organizations. If you're interested in reading more about these, there's this site we put up called theresponsiveorg.com. It's not selling anything. It's just literally we wanted to put it out there because so many of our customers are experiencing these changes. We wanted to see how much of them agreed, in a sense, and it's been really interesting. I want to make this point, though, that even though a lot of what we've talked about here is changing companies and how companies work, it has an impact on individuals as well. That the way that these companies are changing is that individuals in those companies are choosing to work differently. That individuals are saying, you know, I understand that I've got my little group I work with in my hierarchy, but I'm going to go find other people that can help me and just approach them and say, do you want to work together on this? That it's people in those companies that are bucking their company's trends, if you will, or the status quo, to work differently. And that's the way that companies are changing. Or I'm going to go work with my customer. I'm going to go talk to my customer. I was talking to, I think it was, again, the CIO of Red Robin, who said, one of the problems with IT is that we keep saying our customer is the business. But our customer is the customer. Us and the business customer is the customer. Everyone in technology has to get just as close to the end customer as anyone else in the business does. Now, when we talk about these changes, there's a whole bunch of misconceptions that usually come up. People immediately go back on their heels and say, you're talking about anarchy and chaos. And so just to quickly dispel some of those, Some of our, many of our customers, the executives in those companies, are beginning to open up and allow employees to talk directly to them. But they're afraid, usually, that if they were going to invite participation, it would end up being chaos, or they would be forced to run a company through consensus. But all of them are finding that's not the case, that employees are so happy when companies open up that we're not talking about a leadership-less company that is run by consensus. Also, even though we talked about the importance of free information flow and working outside your company, it doesn't mean all information is public. I feel like this is one of the biggest misconceptions of social itself, that they think that working socially means everything is public to everyone in the company. It doesn't mean everything is public to everybody. It means, and this is nuanced, that we're moving from having information be on a need-to-know basis to information be on a need-not-to-know basis. There's things that we want to prevent people from knowing, but we want information to get to the widest possible audience of those that might need that information. When we talk about experimentation, we talk about innovation, companies want to be more innovative. The problem is that requires an increase in failure. It requires focusing on decreasing the cost of failure, but likely increasing the variance and the rate of failure. And so then companies think, well, gosh, does that mean there's no accountability? No, it means changing what we're accountable for. People used to be accountable purely for deliverables, that you did the thing. But people are moving to being accountable for outcomes, that you learned something, that you moved some metric, that you made these customers happier. That's very different than being accountable for just delivering some physical thing, for example. And finally, when we talk about empowering people, we're not talking about having no leadership whatsoever. In fact, leadership becomes more important than ever before. It is true that management is becoming less important. The difference between management and leadership is that managers tell employees exactly what to do. Leaders show a vision, a direction, a decision-making framework, but then work to empower their employees to find the best way to get there. There was a retired four-star U.S. general who said, the wisest decisions are made by those closest to the problem, regardless of seniority. I think that this quote from Jack Welch sort of perfectly sums up exactly what companies are experiencing. Companies are recognizing that the technology has changed everything. We talk about the digital revolution, but what this is the network revolution, that the world has become an interconnected network of people and information. And companies that are trying to operate as rigid hierarchies are struggling to keep up. It is the companies that recognize, and it is the people that recognize, that things have forever changed that will excel today. I mean, the world has fundamentally changed. We know now, companies know, that they're never going to be able to be the same again. And what I will say, which is, you may not believe me, but the reason why I planned this trip to Australia and New Zealand is because I had heard stories that companies here were actually further ahead in their thinking than in a lot of companies in other places. And I've met with now, I don't know, like 10 companies, and it is absolutely true. It's not that companies here have figured everything out, and that's why I don't think, you know, if you look at the outside of the companies, you might say, yeah, that they look like any other company. But on the inside, when I've talked to some of these executives, they're beginning to recognize some of the problems. And I don't know exactly why, but the best explanation I've heard is that people in Australia and New Zealand have a natural questioning of authority and hierarchy. And it turns out that was a necessary thing to begin this transformation, that it requires people to say, hey, maybe the old systems don't work. Maybe we don't have to adhere to them. It requires people taking some risk. But that is that, I think, is the hard part. I was talking to a friend of mine a week or two ago, and I was talking about all these meetings that I have where I talk to people inside the company I work for right now and outside, and how I feel like I take a lot of risks, and at any moment I feel like I could fail. I feel like a lot of the risks I'm taking can result in failure that can push me back, and that I sort of feel like I'm always on the verge of failure. And she said to me, well, of course you feel that way. That's what it means to push boundaries. That's what it means to experiment. It means you're on the verge of failure. And yet it is only through experimentation that we can in any way evolve. And so the sort of final challenge that I will give to the people here and the companies that you work for is that All of these changes represent enormous challenges. A lot of companies are going to cease to exist in the next 5 or 10 years because they can't figure this out. But for each of these challenges, there represents massive opportunities at the individual and the company level. As people, as you, learn how to reorient yourselves about how to learn and respond more rapidly, there's an opportunity to inflect, to compete in a way that is fundamentally different than being a little better than the people or the companies next to you. But it requires that experimentation. It requires an acceptance that you're going to try, you're going to fail, but eventually you're going to succeed ahead where other people haven't. Thank you very much. That's all. Thank you.